Someday when we're dreaming, deep in love, not a lot to say, then we will remember things we said today.
This has been a commemorative broadcast of Earthwatch featuring the late Robert Knight.
And that program was brought to you on recording and produced for WBAI by Catherine Davis. This is WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. I find some of these materials to be utterly fascinating, a picture not just of the time. But last week's program was older. This week's program was not that long ago. And following Robert's progression through all his years as a philosopher and thinker and radio host makes some of these broadcasts thoroughly fascinating. So thank you for putting these together, Kathy Davis. And now, a little howling. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name's Jim Freund. This week, our guest recorded last week is John Allen Simon, writer and director of the movie Radio Free Albemuth, and we'll be talking a lot about translations of Philip K. Dick to cinema and stage. Stay tuned. Oh, and a review of the movie Snowpiercer, reviewed by Dan Persons.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Jim Freund said to me, "It's okay, Dan, you don't have to see Transformers Age of Extinction," for which I was no end of happy, because I'm nothing if not committed to my obligations as a film critic, but why put myself in the path of a whirring, clanking 10-ton pile of manure if I don't really have to? So I promptly said, "Thank you," and got myself over to Snowpiercer, a new film by Korean director Bong Joon-ho that's catching quite a bit of attention for mostly good reason, but therein hangs a tale. The twists start almost immediately. Instead of humankind messing up the Earth with our environmentally wasteful ways, Snowpiercer's big disaster comes when we try to fix things. Doesn't work too well, a deadly freeze settles over the Earth, and 17 years later, the remnants of humanity have all gathered onto a mile-long train, traveling the globe on a circuitous track. As befits rail travel, the passengers are broken up into classes. The more entitled get hot tubs, private suites, and sushi. The bargain riders are herded into stinking, windowless sleeper cars and are fed a disgusting black power sludge. In other words, still better than Spirit Airlines. "Thank you, I'm here all week. Tip your waitresses." There have been previous attempts by the rear-dwelling underclasses to overthrow the abusive first-class passengers in the front cars, but all have failed. Snowpiercer is the story of the latest revolt, led by the charismatic Curtis, played by Chris Evans, and aided and abetted by, among others, an exiled member of the ruling elite, played by John Hurt, and a drug-addicted security specialist and his daughter, played by Bong Joon-ho regulars Song Kang-ho and Ko Ah-sung, respectively. And if you wanted to come up with a narrative mechanism for ushering your characters from one delirious set piece to the next, you couldn't do much better than a near-infinite alignment of railway cars, with each doorway opening onto a new environment and a new kind of obstacle to overcome. Joon-ho takes the risky step of keeping his sets narrow while being unrestrained in their design and uninhibited in their social satire. There's a primary colored classroom where children gleefully insult their less privileged traveling companions, a blacklight illuminated rave slash orgy, a high-class drug den, and on and on. The impression is paradoxically claustrophobic and expansive, a way of constraining everyone, including the filmmaker, into the narrative, while suggesting that anything is possible. The problem is that Joon-ho doesn't seem to be sure about how much recklessness he wants to embrace. The pacing is uneven, with set pieces occasionally overstaying their welcome, and with the narrative occasionally faltering as characters wax philosophical or engage in extended exchanges that could have conveyed the same information and emotional impact in a line or two. At one point, a timer is set for 7 minutes as a member of the ruling class lectures the plebs about the importance of knowing their place in the social strata. And even though the lecturer is Tilda Swinton, playing perhaps the most eccentric rendition of heedless elitism ever captured on screen, and even though the actual running time of the speech is probably not 7 minutes, I know about screen time. It feels like it. And even with a film that clocks in at 2 hours and 5 minutes, that's a long time for speechifying when there's revolution in to get to. I do respect Bong Joon-ho for wanting to work deeper textures into his scenario. And for all that that has led to narrative speed bumps, they're at least cleverly realized speed bumps, which eases a good deal of the frustration. There is another reason for setting a story on a train beside the inherent claustrophobia, and that's how the setting serves as a natural metaphor for propelling a narrative forward. Snowpiercer should have respected that aspect more, but for all of that, it's still a tasty bit of speculative action. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at Cinefantastique Online. Catch up on what you missed by going to CFQOnline.com.
Thank you, Dan. This is annoying because it sounds like a movie I would really like to see, Snowpiercer, except for one thing that was especially brought forth in David Denby's review in The New Yorker, and some other notes. The film is gory. The film has what I call gornography, something we're also going to discuss on the interview that you are about to hear. And that means I just won't be seeing it. And that's a shame, because that prevents me from seeing cinema that I would really like. Don't do that, people. Don't do that. There is no, what doesn't advance your story. Now, I do understand that particularly in Korean film, there is a movement of brilliant, great movie making that invokes a good deal of gore. And this is the fellow who made the movie The Host and Mother. I just can't abide it. It's not entertainment to me if it's going to keep me freaking out all night for years to come. Anyway, all that aside, again, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. I am Jim Freund. Movie adaptations of Philip K. Dick are plentiful. They're not about to stop either. They're going to keep coming at us. And with the exception of a very, very few, even though some are entertaining, very few of them have anything to do with Philip K. Dick. I got an email from Ken Gale of WBAI saying somebody was asking him, do I consider The Matrix being a Philip K. Dick-esque movie? No, not at all. It's a William Gibson-esque movie. And even, and then, by the way, talk about movies that lose their way. Right after the scene with Adelphi, you can give up on the entire trilogy. It's useless. It's pointless. And this kind of thing happens to Dick all the time. Many of the films that are made are based on short stories. Take a, you know, 12-page short story, Minority Report, The Minority Report, and turn it into a 2.5-hour Spielberg Minority Report. Take a 9-page story, We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, and you end up with the, I think it's over 2 hours, it certainly feels like it's over 2 hours, Total Recall. Short stories are often the best inspiration for full-length movies because you can get all the nuance. When you're doing a movie, the question is, how much can you cut out? And how faithful are you going to be to the writer? Well, there have been very, very, very few movies that have been in any way, shape, or form faithful to Philip K. Dick. Of course, the first major one, not counting the I think it was a Twilight Zone, The Electric Ant, that started it all. And then jump ahead to 1982, Blade Runner. Blade Runner has virtually nothing to do with the short story Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which has two protagonists, one of which is the toy maker, which is relegated to a relatively small role. And much of the point of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is about mercerism. It's about religion. It's about the religion in the story. And how does that relate to human beings versus what goes on with the replicants, blah, 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 blah. Okay, creators, and all that. None of that is in the movie. I think it's a gorgeous movie. I've had this argument on the air many, many times. But I don't think that the movie is representative of the work of Philip K. Dick. So moving ahead, after that Total Recall, there is a great moment, 5 minutes in that movie, that is just pure Phil Dick. When they're trying to convince him, when he's on Mars, that he's not, that he's at Total Recall, he's never actually taken the trip. That's great. That's wonderful. Then a couple of years later is a French film that nobody in the world has seen except John Alan Simon, the person we're about to talk to on recording, Barjo, based on the novel Confessions of a Crap Artist. This is a French film. It is very, very hard to find, but if you can, it's well worth seeing. It's a lot of fun. John Simon does not think it represents Dick. I think that if you didn't know it was a Dick movie, you would know it was a Dick movie. It's that close to him. After Barjo, Screamers, based on Second Variety. Not a good movie, not a good adaptation. After that, Imposter, somewhat accurate, but not a very good movie. Minority Report. Yeah, it's got the short story in it, but it's got more to do with L.A. Confidential than it has to do with Philip K. Dick. But again, a beautifully shot movie. Paycheck. I haven't seen it all the way through. Not that interested. A Scanner Darkly, directed by Richard Linklater. Bingo. Right on the mark. Things are taken from the adaptation. You know, it's an adaptation. It's not purely faithful, but it is pure Philip K. Dick from beginning to end. And the movie making, the rotoscope that the director uses, which he also used in Waking Life, which has a great deal to do with Philip K. Dick, and in fact relates to the exegesis of Dick as described in Radio Free Albemuth and Valis, are very much in there. Great. Really fine movie, if not pure adaptation. The Adjustment Bureau, based on the short story. Not bad. I enjoyed it more than other people did. And now, Radio Free Albemuth. Now, it's listed in IMDb as 2010, but in fact, the movie opened last Friday. There was a work in progress, a screener work. There was a Kickstarter. Whoops, pardon me with that microphone, to get it going. It's a whole long story, but hey, we've got an hour-long interview with the writer and director of this movie. And I will tell you one thing. This is not necessarily, I would say, the absolute best movie just in terms of pure cinema of the various things based on Dick, but it is the purest Philip K. Dick movie that you are ever going to see in terms of, does this represent what Dick was writing? Absolutely yes. And the story of the novel is fascinating, and we'll tell you about that as well. So now, part one of an interview conducted on June 23rd with the director and writer of Radio Free Albemuth, John Alan Simon.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf.
Make a liar out of me, Dan, will you? Okay, it's this machine here. Let's try that again. Recording out in Brooklyn, I am Jim Freund. With me is John Alan Simon, movie director. And you have quite a resume of everything from critic, reader, writer, producer.
Yeah, I think of myself primarily as a writer. I studied literature in college and was an editor of the Harvard Crimson there, and loved movies and loved music. And even though I have a tremendous knowledge about music, I don't play, so there was no way I was ever going to be a musician. And it kind of got tiring writing about music, so I moved more into writing about film, which I really loved the most. And Roger Ebert would go on vacation. He recommended me to fill in for him at the Sun-Times while I was in grad school. And then after that, I went down to New Orleans as a staff writer for the Times-Picayune. And the older film critic there wasn't quite ready to leave, which I thought was too bad for me. But it actually turned out to be very good because they let me pretty much write whatever I wanted. So I got to do things like spend time on death row at Angola State Penitentiary and study medicine secrets with the last medicine woman of the Chitimacha tribe. Wow. And go alligator hunting and follow Bob Dylan around on tour. Pretty much whatever I like to do, they they let me do for a while at least. And after that, I kind of got into the film business through a friend who was the TV film critic down there after I'd started writing film reviews for the paper. And we found a shelved movie called The Wicker Man, which we released very successfully, and that kind of launched me into the film business.
Now, we do have to tell listeners we're not discussing a film with Nicolas Cage. We're talking about Edward Woodward.
And Christopher Lee.
Yeah, Britt Eklund, I believe.
And Britt Eklund. It was directed by Robin Hardy. It had a really interesting history. Warners had test marketed it and shelved it after trying it out in drive-ins in Atlanta. We restored the movie to the intentions of the director and released it places like the Orson Welles Cinema in Cambridge and the Lumiere in San Francisco and broke House Records and really created kind of a cult film out of it. It's one of
great
the things I'm very
also.
Proud of.
Great
Lovely soundtrack. And then after that, I did a similar thing with a Dennis Hopper movie called Out of the Blue, which is also very much about music, as is the science fiction film I'm here to talk about today, Radio Free Albemuth, from the novel by Philip K. Dick, which is very much about music and the music business, the power of art, the power of music, in the form of a sci-fi conspiracy thriller.
Yeah, as the better Philip K. Dick movie. Well, I guess they're all skiffy conspiracy thrillers, except there are so few of them that are any good. But one of my favorite Philip K. Dick movies isn't any kind of thriller or conspiracy thing at all, and that's Barjo.
Oh, Barjo is lovely, from one of his nonfiction books, Confessions
of
a Crap Artist.
Yeah, non-science fiction.
Mainstream fiction,
right.
Yeah. Well, he set out to be a mainstream writer, and wrote five or six novels. A couple of them have been lost, none of which got published during his lifetime. But he then returned and took a stab at it with Confessions of a Crap Artist. And it was made into a very charming French film. And if you saw it and didn't know it was from a Philip K. Dick book, you would probably never guess that it was, I think.
Oh, you see, I felt the opposite. I thought that if you didn't know that it was Philip K. Dick, you would say, you know, this is very much like him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I very much had that feeling. I have a copy, actually.
Well, people should seek it out. I saw it when it first came out. It is hard to find. There are some very good movies that are hard to find. There's a great French adaptation of a Jim Thompson novel, another great pulp writer who wrote The Grifters and The Getaway, a movie called Série Noire, which is from Thompson's A Hell of a Woman. And it's a terrific adaptation. And that's also very unavailable. I hearken from the days when sometimes you would drive 50 miles to see a movie you wanted to see, as opposed to today, when every movie at all times is everywhere, however you want to watch it, which of course makes it very challenging for me as a filmmaker. This is my first time as a director, but I've produced films and been involved with lots of films in other ways, and developed lots of projects that didn't get made at studios as a writer and producer. But finally we decided with this one to go forth and gird our loins and make something that is really in many ways quite different than anything I think people are used to seeing, unless they go to see things like Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream or The Fountain or Pi or Shane Carruth's Upstream Color, or movies that are, you know, just a little bit off kilter, that aren't quite like everything else out there, which is why Hollywood doesn't make them. They don't know how to market them.
It's why these are independents, although Hollywood tries. They have each bought up independent distribution houses like Fox Searchlight and all that.
Well, Fox Searchlight is a terrific company. I know the people who work there, lots of them, and they're very, very good at a certain kind of offbeat comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And even they, when they pick up movies like Another Earth or Choke, have a really hard time marketing them.
I don't know Choke. I liked Another Earth.
Choke was written by the writer of Fight Club, whose last name I find it very hard to pronounce, Chuck Pahuliak, I think is my best stab at it. Please forgive me if you're listening, or if anyone who knows his work is
the just, dangers of radio.
He's just gasping at my mispronunciation. But movies like that, they find it very difficult to market. And their criteria for picking up movies is, you know, they have to be movies that would justify spending $2 to $4 million marketing, even at that small level, as opposed to studio movies where the marketing is $30 million and up, up, up.
Yeah. Very often part of the huge cost of the film that we hear about, a good chunk of that is the marketing. Now, I started hearing about Radio Free Albemuth quite a few years ago, and I've seen that it's listed, I think, variably as like a 2008, 2009 film. I know that there were screenings as recently as, or I should say as far back as 2 or 3 years ago, at least in chunks, if nothing else. But it has never before gotten a proper release, which it is going to have this very week.
Well, this is one of the ways in which the deck is kind of stacked against independent filmmakers. IMDb, where everyone thinks is, you know, so right and wonderful about everything, they pick the first time it's ever shown in public in any form as the release date. So we showed the movie as a work in progress in around 2009, because we had the opportunity to, so we kind of got saddled with that release date, even though it has nothing to do with when the movie was finished, and it certainly has nothing to do with when it was released. The movie's copyrighted 2014, and I was finishing it up even into January of this year. There's 250 CGI shots in the movie, and doing about 12 minutes of CGI on a budget that's equivalent to 1 second of Avatar's budget was not an easy undertaking. And, you know, I had to do a lot of handcrafted work with individual special effects technicians. And there's an old saying, good, fast, or cheap, pick two of the three. And we were aiming for good, and we were stuck with cheap, so it wasn't fast.
Right. What was the entire budget on the film?
You know, we don't say what the entire budget was. Not so much because we're shy, but because it's kind of It's one of those things people think they want to know and think they'll understand, but it's actually untrue. For example, Alanis Morissette, who's in the movie, wrote a song for the movie and sings it in it. The background of the movie is the music business, even though it's sci-fi. And an Alanis Morissette song to license is upwards of $250,000. Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's say we agreed that she gave it to us gratis, but let's say, for example, we were going to pay her the $250 as a deferral. Mm-hmm. Would you count it as nothing, the value of the song, in the budget?
Well,
or do you add those things into the budget? Is the budget only the cash? If this table that we're looking at, if you made it from scratch, went out to the forest, cut down trees, dragged them back, but used 50 cents of nails and a year of your time to sand and carve this table, is it a 50-cent table?
Well, I think that the question indicates, you know, you mentioned Aronofsky before, and people still talk about how Pi was made, amazingly at, I don't remember what it was, but it was well under $1 million. Now his latest movie is $170 million, Noah. So that's really the kind of question I think people are asking is
this a big budget studio movie? No, it isn't. Is it a $6,000 movie or even a $100,000 movie? No, it isn't. It's
somewhere in between.
It's in the middle range. You know, people who look at the movie think that it's somewhere between, you know, $5 and $10 million. And some do.
I would have guessed more.
Okay. You would have guessed more?
Yeah, but I mean, but I don't know the business.
But again, then you have to understand that none of the producers, uniquely on any film I've ever been involved with, took any fees. One of our producers produced The Sessions, which was the big hit out of Sundance a couple of years ago with Helen Hunt and John Hawks, and he produced Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. His producing fee is $250,000 or more on every film he makes. My producing fee, I produce studio-level movies like The Getaway with Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger. My producing fee is in that range. So if Chip Rosenblum, who's my partner in acquiring the rights on these projects, you know, he gets that kind of fee, too. So just even if you had the producer's fees in there, it would be, you know, over $1 million if we were doing it for a studio, you know, which doesn't add anything to what's on the screen, really. And the book rights for a Philip K. Dick novel are now upwards of $1 million. We did not recoup any of the book rights out of the budget of the movie, again, uniquely to how people usually operate in Hollywood. So it was an indie labor of love, the way this table would have been if you built it from scratch by hand. And, you know, you wouldn't sell it for the 50 cents of nails that you put into it, nor would anyone expect you to. But also, oddly enough, in Hollywood, no one ever thinks you should make any more than your film cost. So, you know, people lie. Big surprise in Hollywood. They lie. And when they say their movie cost a little, it's so you're impressed with how well they did after the movie's been acquired. But before the movie was acquired, they generally lie that it cost a lot more. So simply because I hate that game, I just don't talk about what the budget is. It really, you know, it really doesn't matter. If the movie's good, it's good. If it's bad, it's bad. And what it cost is, you know, is not that germane. It's like asking what you, in a way, it's like asking what did you pay for your house 20 years ago in order to try to decide what I'm going to pay for it now. It doesn't
matter. Well, for me, it's a question, and then we'll move on.
Sure.
It's a question of, We live in the blockbuster era, the post-Star Wars era, in which film is, and we're in the season right now, this being June. It starts in May and it goes, it's been extended to August. August used to be a bit of a dead dog. Reruns were there and other movies came in. But the summer films now extend to August. So it's a May to August blockbuster season. And, pardon me, it has always been my contention that you can make great science fiction on, well, of course, I'm a radio producer, so for me, I say my special effects are better than that of James Cameron's, because close your eyes, think of Beautiful Planet. Oop, we just did it. So, didn't spend a penny on it either. Practical effects. I've seen great Philip K. Dick on stage.
So have I. I've seen Radio Free Albemuth on stage and on a barren stage, and it was, you know, it had great characters, intriguing ideas, and wonderful dialogue, and you know, those are the things that matter in a movie. You know, I watch a lot of these special effects movies. You know, Transformers, whichever number you care to pick, and I just am bored by them, truthfully. The effects are,
the effects are, see any of the Transformers.
Yeah, the effects are amazing, and you believe every minute when the cars are transforming into robots. You just don't believe the human beings who are talking in them.
Yes.
They don't seem real.
Screenplays help.
Yeah, screenplays help, and there's something else, you know, when you're making a movie or you're making any kind of art for purely to get it across to the largest audience possible, then how much it cost, how long it took you to do it, all of that kind of matters. But truthfully, who cares whether it took Herman Melville, you know, 1 year or 10 years to write Moby Dick. You know, it is what it is. You know, maybe you think he wasted his time. I don't. You know, I'm sure a lot of people who spent 10 years writing perfectly dreadful novels. I'm not saying that taking a long time is the hallmark of quality, but all I'm saying is, to me, as a former critic and as a current filmmaker, it honestly doesn't matter.
What were the other plays based? The two that I saw were the Mabu Mines production of Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, which I believe the script of which was then done by other companies. They first did it in Boston and did it in two different productions in New York.
And they also did in L.A. twice, that same.
Did Mabu Mines do it or some?
No, other companies.
I'm saying Mabu Mines did the one in Boston and two in New York. And Linda
Hartinian.
Right, and her husband.
Wrote the adaptation.
Yeah.
But it's really...
Her husband directed it here. And I had both of them on my program at the time, and they are the ones who had the experiences with Phil Dick. She was a close friend of Dick's. And also, the other one I saw is more recent, about 3 years ago, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, written and directed by Edward Einhorn, who has done some rather good science fiction.
That just played in Los Angeles a few months ago, and I've seen all the stage adaptations, and in fact, interestingly, we have the film rights to Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, and it's because of that I was able to do Radio Free Album with. I did a spec script on Flow My Tears that was optioned by a studio, and major talent were attached, Oliver Stone and Tom Cruise, and they paid us a lot of money for the option and paid me a lot of money for the rewrite. And even though the project kind of fell apart, it was enough money that we were able to exercise the rights on the three novels that we had under option. We also have Valis under option, had it under option. We now own it. And Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, I always intended to be a big studio movie or that level with a major star and major
director. A major star would be only appropriate for that, given the storyline.
Yes, given that the main character is a major star. You know, you can imagine somebody like George Clooney having a lot of fun with the part.
Oh, he would be good in that, yeah.
Although we better make it quickly, since, you know, none of us are getting any younger. And Valis, we've always thought about probably as some kind of extended TV series, particularly in light of the great television that's being done today. I mean, the big ray of hope and light really is that TV is getting more and more interesting and adventurous at a time when movies are kind of shutting down in a way. I don't think I could get Radio Free Album with made today, even at the modest budget that we made it at, even with everyone deferring their salaries, even with all the actors like Shea Whigham from Boardwalk Empire, who plays Philip K. Dick in the movie. The character that he wrote into the novel. Catherine Winnick from Vikings, Alanis Morissette, Ashley Green from Twilight does a cameo. Terrific actors like John Tenney from The Closer and Rich Summer from Mad Men are in the film, simply because they liked the material. It certainly wasn't, they didn't like $200 a day SAG minimum fees for doing it. But even with that kind of paradigm for making a movie, I don't think you could get it. I really don't know that you could get it made today. It took us a long time to get it made.
Well, it's very interesting that on the one hand, we seem to have, you know, the big budget. Even the big blockbusters are getting to be a little more intelligent. At least the Marvel films, thanks to the Joss Whedon thing, and they're going to try to model Star Wars now after that same model at Disney, you know, where everything interlocks and one movie links into another, and bringing in lesser-known directors who've done mostly indie films and giving them huge budgets. But the interesting things seem to be happening largely, I would guess, thanks to George Martin and the success of Game of Thrones, which I don't watch because I love George Martin, but I like his science fiction. I'm not into the gore and the gornography, as I call it, so I can't watch that series. But the fact that they could take something that was legitimate genre material and turn it into such a success. We're also in cinema, we're also post Lord of the Rings, although I think that what made that good also made it bad. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly being proven by The Hobbit, which I am not a fan of the film. Amazing things on screen, but it's not Tolkien. One of the next big things for HBO is American Gods by Neil Gaiman, who has had his success with cinema. But the idea now of taking, to go out of the genre, Fargo just finished on FX, and it was like a 10-hour movie. It really had wit and intelligence. It wasn't the Coen brothers, but it sure felt like it.
Right. Well, you know, that's the kind of material that I think turns people on. And, you know, we tried very hard to make a Radio Free Album with the kind of movie that was being made at one time. You know, movies like Drugstore Cowboy or Sex, Lies, and Videotape, or a movie that really influenced me, a wonderful movie that not that many people have seen, but I'll bet you have, called Cutter's Way.
Yes.
Which was one of Jeff Bridges' first terrific parts, with an amazing John Hurd playing his kind of eccentric friend, and Lisa Eichorn. And in many ways, it's structurally very similar to Radio Free Album, with three friends who uncover a conspiracy that really threatens to eat them alive. They're kind of slackers in Radio Free Album, as they were in Cutter's Way, and they're a little bit in their heads, so to speak, and just things are bigger and scarier than they can even imagine. So I thought that was a wonderful movie, and that was the kind of movie I wanted to make. The movie, even though it's science fiction, it's an alternate reality. It takes place in 1985. President, much like Nixon, but I've kind of morphed him a little bit into Bush and Reagan, as played by Scott Wilson from Walking Dead, who's a friend and a terrific actor, who, if people only know him from Walking Dead, they must go out and see Richard Brooks in Cold Blood to see his screen debut as one of the killers in Truman Capote's book.
Okay. He's the one who was in Robert Blake.
Yeah, opposite Robert Blake. But in any case, you know, it's a it's the kind of film that if you want not just to be sort of numbed out and massaged by spectacle, if you want a movie that kind of stimulates your brain cells. I mean, that's what Philip K. Dick was about. He had these, as you know, he had these visionary experiences in 1974 where he heard voices and saw things, saw images, and decided that perhaps it was this extraterrestrial intelligence that he called Valis, for Vast Active Living Intelligence System. And it obsessed him for the last 10 years of his life. He wrote a million-word journal about it, speculating as to what it was. Was it God? Was it aliens? He had a lot of fun with that, but it was more than fun. He turned it into art, and Radio Free Albemuth was his first attempt to turn it into art, making it science fiction and making himself the friend of the guy who's having these strange experiences. He's the skeptical friend in the novel and in the movie. And I just thought that was
delightful. Which is funny, given also the fact that he was a schizophrenic. Thereby, in both Radio Free Albemuth, figuratively, and in Valis, literally, turning himself into two people, horse feather fat, not to give away any spoilers,
That's in Vallis, but he wasn't ever diagnosed as a schizophrenic, and I don't think he was. In fact, he used to tell the story that after he heard these visions and after he had these visions and heard these voices, he started seeing a shrink. And he was very concerned that he might be schizophrenic. And after about 6 months of therapy, the shrink said to him, "Well, I've finally diagnosed you." And Philip K. Dick said, "Well, tell it to me straight. Am I schizophrenic?" And the doctor said, "No, you're not schizophrenic. You're obsessive compulsive. And your obsession compulsion is that you think you're a schizophrenic."
Okay.
Now, come on. How crazy can a guy who would even make up that story be, right?
Well, he was of his, he was of his era, but even then, I always found it impossible to believe his claim, although it does seem to be legitimate, that he never did psychedelics, because his experiences are too close.
Oh, no, he did. I'm told that he did. He said that at one point, because he was somewhat he was slightly paranoid. In fact, there's a line in the movie where he says the rumor got started that I'd written Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch under the influence of LSD. It increased my sales, but, it made me visible to the authorities.
Yeah.
And then
he got outed by Ellison in
Dangerous Visions. Harlan Ellison, for who he never forgave. They had a very thorny relationship.
Dick had thorny relationships with a lot of people, and you don't get, listen to me carefully, Harlan, thornier than Harlan Ellison, as I can well attest. And Dick, I did not know well. I met him for 5 minutes. But he was certainly on a rap. And apparently there are any number of people who saw him that same night. And he was on a different rap to each one of those people and keeping them all straight. Following his interviews that he did with my now passed away colleague, Mike Hodel, at our Los Angeles station, those are available on the DVD extras of Scanner Darkly. And they're also available, I should say, at the Pacifica Archives. So all rightful thinking radio listeners should go to the Pacifica Archives and look up Philip K. Dick. But he could be very lucid. He could be very clear, especially in the late 70s, early 80s. And I've always thought of him as having eras, like Picasso had the Blue Period, the Cubist Period. I always thought of stories like Ubik as being the what is reality type story, and then stories like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep as what is the authentic human being. And then there is what I call, and other people have called, the exegesis stories, but I'm putting a whole clump of them together, his religious synthesis of everything from Coptic Christian thinking, very, very much into that, which is, I know, and that actually brings up a question. I notice that the movies you've either optioned or now own, the properties that you have, seem to come out of that whole Coptic period. Certainly, Radio Free Albemuth is probably the very beginning of that, and that got thrown away for controversial reasons, or put in the trunk, is the way somebody else might say it. That leads to Vallis, which is quite...
Well, Philip K. Dick, was very widely read in philosophy, and the Gnostic version of Christianity really appealed to him. The Dead Sea Scrolls and the idea that, like in The Matrix, that the world may be an illusion. I mean, that goes all the way back to Plato, that there's the shadow in the cave.
And there's actually a word for it that Dick is always bringing up, and it's in Radio Free Albemuth, and it's the opposite of amnesia.
Anamnesis, which is the idea that you wake up to what you have forgotten. It isn't that you've forgotten. It's the opposite of amnesia, that you come awake. And, you know, look, all great literature, a lot of it, and great religious and philosophical systems are about the idea of becoming more aware and more awake. And for Dick, he felt that there was there had to be more to reality than just the material level, because otherwise, what is consciousness? And how does consciousness take in the world and take in reality? Where do these things actually exist? If it's all perceived in a brain, how is it relate to what is outside that brain? You know, for all that neuroscience tells us, you know, I don't know that they'll ever get to that point. As, you know, I call Radio Free Album with a spiritual movie for atheists or agnostics. I think it's a spiritual movie even Richard Dawkins, who I greatly admire, could like, because it posits the idea that we are in some way the product of alien intelligence.
You should get in touch, by the way, with David Silverman, who is the head of the American Atheist Association, whose wife puts out Space and Time magazine.
Yeah, well, that sounds like right up my alley. In any case,
he claims I'm an atheist because I'm an agnostic. So he's, shall we say, more inclusive than the previous generations of atheists for whom atheism was faith.
Well, even Dawkins is an agnostic. He just says he's, you know, 99.99% agnostic.
Yeah, well, Madeline Murray O'Hare, who I had the misfortune to engineer, was 100% certain.
Yes.
So much so that she was religious fervor. She had religious fervor about her atheism.
Well, I think it's impossible to be 100% certain of almost anything. And Philip K. Dick certainly is the opposite of that other science fiction writer who shall remain nameless, who founded a religion and claimed or may have had spiritual revelations, and has become very influential among the
Hollywood set. I have no problems naming Isaac Asimov. No, somebody else. But I interviewed L. Ron Hubbard Jr. on my program. I've dealt a lot with people. And let us not forget that religion to which you are referring grew out of the science fiction field, insofar as it was first published in Astounding, that among its first priests were A.E. Van Vogt and Aldous Budrys. It really grew out of there. I do know that both Van Vogt and Budrys were sincere in their beliefs. I will not speak for the founder.
Well, Philip K. Dick didn't want anybody to start a church of Philip K. Dick. For him, if there was a church, it was based on the idea of skepticism and eternal questioning and trying to use the rational mind. For me, as somebody who is a rationalist, but somebody who also does believe in mystical experiences and have had mystical experiences of my own, Radio Free Albemuth is really about trying to understand what faith is and coming to some kind of peace with faith.
Okay, we're back from having...
No, we're not. That was the segue, and it just started happening on its own without permission, because instead I wanted to come live to you and tell you that you're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. The program you are listening is called Hour of the Wolf. My name is called Two, Jim Freund. And on recording from last week is John Allen Simon, author and director of the movie Radio Free Albemuth, based on the novel published only posthumously by Philip K. Dick. And we're actually just about to tell you the story of how that occurred. And the story, there have been several stories. Dick was, of course, I think the technical term that they use is Meshuggah. And he could tell a story a number of ways to a number of different people. So, but the story that John heard in L.A. and I heard in New York, and one of my sources is Ron Goulart, who in San Francisco rather than in L.A., was Philip K. Dick's neighbor. By the way, for the record, once upon a time, yes, Philip K. Dick was the record librarian at KPFA. So it all goes in circles. We now return to the second half of the interview with John Allen Simon.
Okay, we're back from having taken a break, and we know that Radio Free Albemuth was only published posthumously, and the story goes, I'm going to start it, and you'll pick it up, that Dick had written Radio Free Albemuth. It was sent back for notes, and he decided to write Valis instead. Can you flesh that story out?
I think that that's the crux of what you said is the issue. He decided to write Valis instead. I find that very difficult to believe as a writer, truthfully. He had called the novel Valis System A. The exegesis is about all the variations on what this experience might have been, all the different scenarios. I find it difficult to believe that a new editor who was concerned that Philip K. Dick was too religious in Radio Free Albemuth, who sent back that as his primary note, that Philip K. Dick decided that on the basis of a new editor's note after, a distinguished career as a science fiction writer, having just been anointed the greatest science fiction mind on any planet by Rolling Stone, would even deign to take any notes from anybody, truthfully, and that he would decide to abandon a novel and rewrite it, I find kind of ridiculous, given what I understand of his character. I think whatever the evidence might be, and I think Tim Powers has agreed with this when we've spoken about it, that, you know, it's very easy to imagine that Valis would have been Valis System B. After all, he did write three more novels after Radio Free Albemuth around many of the same themes and concerns. He was very obsessive compulsive about wanting to understand this experience and using it in his fiction. So in any case, after Valis was published, Philip K. Dick, living in Orange County, befriending a young science fiction writer, Tim Powers, gave him a manuscript and told him to hold on to it, that it was very important and would be worth a lot someday. And on it was Valis System A is the title, but crossed out in pencil and written under it, Radio Free Albemuth. It seems to me that having wanted it published while he was alive as written, and having given it to Tim Powers, he could easily have destroyed it, and having given it a different name, it was clearly, I think, a case could be made that he wanted it to be published. He wanted it to be published under that name. And in many ways, it's the missing link, I think, in his work between two of his masterpieces, A Scanner Darkly and Valis. And it really takes the science fiction themes of his work to their final and ultimate conclusion. Because after Radio Free Albemuth, I think it's easy to argue that Valis is not science fiction in any traditional sense of the word, and that certainly Divine Invasion, which is another Valis novel, is kind of the Hebrew Kabbalah mystical interpretation of the New Testament as a science fiction space opera of the Second Coming. And then his final novel, Transmigration of Timothy Archer, isn't science fiction at all. It's a mainstream novel. So I really see Radio Free Albemuth as the fourth Valis novel. And in many ways, I think there are a lot of people who find it much more accessible than Valis. And I like them both. I don't feel like I have to choose in any sense.
I like them both, but for very different reasons. And I would dissent with you only insofar as far as I'm concerned, with the exception of what he really considered his mainstream work. And even Confessions of a Crap Artist is science fiction. To quote David G. Hartwell, science fiction is the wrong and only name for it. It's, to quote Damon Knight, science fiction is what I'm pointing at, which is the best definition I know for science fiction. If you start defining it one way or another, and trying to build the taxonomy, the time travel isn't science fiction because it can only be fantasy because time can only flow one way. It doesn't matter. It's still a part of the literature, a part of the genre that Dick embraced, with the exception of earlier novels that he had written that he absolutely intended to get to a mainstream market.
But I think Transmigration of Timothy Archer, I don't see any science fiction element in it. Maybe I need to reread it. It just seems to be a very
It's been a while since I read
novel.
It, but only about 12, 13 years. I think that what was coming around is, I mentioned earlier, that I think that Dick wrote in phases, that he would obsess or think about a particular thing at a particular time. And I think that what we have after the religious books, I don't call them all the Valis books, but the religious books.
I would call them mystical books. I don't know that I don't think they're religious books. They're philosophical.
Well, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep with a religion?
Sure, Mercerism. But
that's
he,
it. Thank you.
But he, but Dick did feel that he was on to something after 1974.
Oh yes,
and that obsessed him, and he was interested in that. And just like William Butler Yeats had mystical experiences via his wife, who would go into a trance state, and the poet William Blake, both of whom I studied. I pretty much spent my college years focusing on those two writers. I see Philip K. Dick very much in that same tradition, and nobody ever asks whether William Blake or William Butler Yeats were insane, but somehow, because he was a science fiction writer, a lot of people do ask that about Philip K. Dick, which I think people who know him, knew him, of which I guess you're one.
No, I met him for 5 minutes.
Well, that's more than most of the 5 billion people on the planet have done, so I envy you that. The people who knew him are pretty convinced he wasn't. And proving either he was totally bonkers or not at all bonkers, he was elected to his condo board few years of his life.
I don't know how you can, A, qualify anybody as bonkers or not at a science fiction convention. B, judge not yet, lest you be judged. But the thing I was going to say is that I think that after Transmigration of Timothy Archer, and then going into, just to use novels as time pieces, Scanner Darkly, as well as the short stories, The Exit Door Leads In, and there's another one, one of my favorites, and one of his very last stories about the guy who's on this multi-hundred-year space journey where the computer has to keep him sane and focuses on a Gilbert Shelton Fat Freddy Cat poster. I think that he was transitioning from what had been one phase of his, he had at least three already, into another one, which was again, another uber reality.
Well, unfortunately, we'll never know. We know the novel he had planned to write next was Owl in Daylight, which had a much more science fiction sounding kind of basis. But one thing about Dick is he would write in letters and talk about things he was going to write, and very often they bore absolutely no resemblance to what he said he had written or what he said he was going to write. So there's still a lot of research and scholarship to be done by Dick. But, you know, for those who just enjoy it sort of on a slightly less academic level, of which I guess I would include myself. You know, what we wanted to do with this movie was really have fun with the themes and the some of the conventions of Philip K. Dick's work and his politics. I mean, when people ask me what the most authentic Philip K. Dick movie is, and I'm a fan of Blade Runner, and I'm a fan of all of them in certain ways, I always say the two best Philip K. Dick movies so far are Brazil and 12 Monkeys, neither of which are from Philip K. Dick novels, but both of which, Terry Gilliam's films, capture the kind of the Kafka-esque humor and the man against civilization notions that I think make Philip K. Dick a really humanistic and interesting writer.
See, one of the things I would have actually chosen Inside John Malkovich as one of the best.
Yeah, that's I agree.
That Philip K. Dick never wrote.
I agree. Inside John Malkovich, and also
Brazil,
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is another very
good one. I still haven't seen it. I like his other films, but Brazil is typical Tom Stoppard. Everything about that is Tom Stoppard. Say Kafka-esque, they came from the same town, but Stoppard and Kafka.
Sure, but what? But Terry Gilliam, who's very Dickian and is a big fan of
Dick, yeah.
I think the police state stuff and all of that.
But Tom Stoppard was shopping around the screenplay, and Gilliam bought it.
Yeah, that's true. But I still think it's very Dickian.
And, oh, yeah, it absolutely
whether
is.
And not to take anything away from Tom Stoppard,
especially the multiple endings that Gilliam tacked on at the end, the multiple realities.
Yes, the multiple realities. That's all extremely Dickian.
And that was not in Stoppard's screenplay, apparently. That was
so you've just argued yourself into agreement with me, I think.
I wasn't arguing against you. I was saying that I think Stoppard's...
I said argued yourself.
Yeah, no. I think Stoppard's DNA is the greater DNA of that movie, obviously. As you know, any director... now, you have the luxury, few directors have, of being the author, director, producer.
Yeah, I'm not the only producer, and I wasn't the financier, so
But you worked on three levels.
Yes, I got to work on three levels. But, you know, every director really works on three levels. You know, most directors, the director is responsible for everything. You know, I like to say that if you don't like the movie, please blame me. Because I certainly had the control of the movie. No one else did. But if you like the movie, there are so many other people who collaborated and contributed to it, you know, from the score to the effects to the actors' performances.
Very nice score, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Very pleased with the score. Ralph Grierson, our composer, is an amazing musician also, who played keyboards and piano on most of John Williams' most famous scores, mm-hmm. like E.T. And in fact, he shattered his wrist playing with Williams at a 30th or 40th anniversary screening of E.T. at the Shrine Auditorium. Backstage, he tripped on a cable, and it kind of set him off into composing. He was a big Philip K. Dick fan and a real Hollywood story, L.A. story. A massage therapist told me about him and said, you know, he wants to start composing. You should talk to him. And I did. And then I was also lucky enough that the great English singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock, mm-hmm. whose new album just got, a 4.5-star review in Rolling Stone, I always thought he was the musical equivalent of Philip K. Dick. And the actor Alan Rickman.
And we shouldn't mention the opera based on Vallas, which I broadcast.
Yeah. Well, I'm fond of that. I
haven't listened to it in many, many, many years.
It's very avant-garde. It's not for the faint of heart. You're not going to put it on while you're while you're reading the newspaper.
You're not going to whistle the tune after you've heard it.
You won't be whistling the tune. It makes John Adams or Philip Glass sound very melodic. But in any case, one of the producers on the movie, who I should have mentioned, Elizabeth Carr, who helped me cast the movie and worked very hard during post-production also. She was friends with the actor, Alan Rickman, and I had approached Robin Hitchcock about doing music for the film.
We're getting our own soundtrack, I notice. But go on. Outside. One of the members of the Byrds.
Ah, is it Roger McGuinn?
No, just somebody mocking him. But we have mockingbirds nesting here.
I see. Well, Robin, when I approached him at an in-store appearance, I said, "Are you a Philip K. Dick fan?" Said to me in a kind of very snotty way, I felt, "No, I don't read science fiction. I just read literature." And I thought, well, this is never going to happen. But we were having dinner with Alan Rickman, and I said, "This really eccentric singer-songwriter is playing a few blocks away. I want to go hear him. Do you want to come?" And he said, "Who?" And I said, "Robin Hitchcock." He said, "Oh, he's a great mate of mine." I said, "Well, in that case..." And when the movie was in rough cut, Alan got Robin to look at it, and he worked on the score, contributed portions to it, and even more importantly, gave us 8 songs for the movie that I think are tremendous. To me, in the alternate reality of Radio Free Albemuth, or at least in the alternate reality of my head, Robin Hitchcock is right up there with Bob Dylan and the Beatles as a really culturally treasured artist. And by me, he is a culturally
artist.
Could still happen. R.E.M. kind of plays his backup band, used to, in the Decemberists have him open for them. He's influenced a lot of people, and he's kind of like, if Sid Barrett, I think Rolling Stone said he's like Sid Barrett if he'd settled down a bit.
Now, talk about somebody with issues, who Stoppard also wrote about. But anyway, of course, something just flew out of my mind along with...
Well, I'll talk about my movie then.
Well, yeah, well, that is what we were going to do. Oh, I was just going to make a comment about the people who say, "I don't read science fiction, I only read literature." That snobbish old statement, when you then show them good science fiction, they say, "Well, that's not science fiction, that's literature."
Well, there you go. In other words, you know, it's like the people who are racist but still enjoyed, you know, Lena Horne or Paul Robeson or certain other artists, and they made an exception for them. They weren't really black, I guess. If they were racist enough, you know, they could somehow filter it out. And, you know, it's a real prejudice. When I was a kid, I loved science fiction. I devoured Heinlein and Sheckley and Silverberg and A. Van Vogt, who I loved, Worlds of Nellie, and Frederick Pohl. These were writers I really enjoyed. And then, like many people, I started reading things like Orwell's 1984 and Huxley's Brave New World, and it kind of transitioned me, because they didn't primarily write science fiction. I transitioned into reading other kinds of literature. And then, you know, in grad school, I kind of discovered that there were these writers like Thomas Dish and Philip K. Dick and Barry Maltzberg and Robert Silverberg, 2.0 Robert Silverberg, who, and Norman Spinrad, and quite a few others, who, and Ursula Le Guin, who had, kind of moved science fiction much more into the literary avant-garde. And I gravitated very strongly towards that kind of science fiction. And
interesting that most of the people you're naming are people that, if we're not already established in the new wave was helping retool them, like Frederick Pohl in Dangerous Visions with The Day After the Day the Martians Came, and Le Guin was already established, but she made her mark in there. So a lot of what you're talking about to me sort of relates to that, what was in the late 60s, early 70s, the new wave.
Yeah, it definitely is, and it definitely impressed me very strongly that whatever prejudices I had inherited from my first-rate literary education at Harvard as an undergraduate, you know, were incorrect in assuming that genre fiction could not be literature except with the rare exceptions of things like 1984 or Huxley's Brave New World, that there was really a whole new wave of this. And it was also true with noir, with pulp.
I was going to say
pulp detective fiction when I discovered, you know, Jim Thompson primarily, who's been a major influence.
I'll tell you who Dick reminds me of as a writer in so many ways. Chandler.
Yeah, there is a lot. And in fact, I tried to really make use of Chandler's relation to Marlowe, his fictional alter ego, in the way that I approached characterizing Philip K. Dick in Radio Free Albemuth. Mm-hmm. I really had that very much in mind, that it would... it wasn't Philip K. Dick in our reality who's in Radio Free Albemuth. It was Philip K. Dick's idea of himself. I like to say, you know, that I think most men, when they look in the mirror and shave in the morning, they see a face other than their own. You know, I see sort of a combination.
So this is through a mirror darkly.
Or through a mirror brightly.
Brightly, better yet.
I see a combination of Cary Grant and Michael Caine in my mirror when I shave, and I'm not sure.
You are not Cockney, sir. Both of them are. But
I'm not what?
You're not a Cockney. As both Mr. Grant or Mr. Leach and Mr.
That's
Kane
right.
are.
That's true. But, but in any case, I...
Also, I just... Instead of just adapting it for a low common denominator.
Yeah, we could have easily made this as an action-adventure movie. People kept telling us, put in... you know, spaceships and put in ray gun fights. And I just could not have lived with myself doing that to this novel. So we made it at a very responsible budget. We had a private financing of the movie, and we raised the money for the release on Kickstarter. And, you know, the great thing about those platforms is they engage people. Instead of people who were irritated that it was taking a long time to get out, instead of pirating the movie and torrenting it, you know, they joined us, and they're going to get a download, or they're going to get a special edition DVD, or they're going to get a bound copy of the script with an original drawing inspired by Valis, by yours truly, if he can ever sit down and paint again. I love that Bukowski used to do that, one of my other favorite pulp writers. Bukowski often did limited editions with oil paintings in them, which are now worth $4,000 or $5,000, which I haven't yet had to sell.
As I recall, he was a favorite of Dick's.
Was Bukowski a favorite of Dick's? I don't know
For
that.
Some reason, I'm not sure of it, but for some reason, some outer living system is just putting that into my head.
Well, if you like rock and roll, and who doesn't, and if you like political conspiracy thrillers like 1984, The Manchurian Candidate, both of which very influenced Dick in the writing of this, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And if you like, you know, movies about friendship and what it means and about sacrifice, I think this is a movie I'd like you to check out. And, you know, we're always available through our Facebook page, where there's a lot of great conversations about all of these things we're talking about.
And the name of that page is Radio Free.
It's Radio Free Albemuth Movie on Facebook.
Okay.
And through our website, www.radiofreealbemuth.com, where you can get some of these things, posters and the special edition DVDs and the special edition of the script. And, you know, we want your help. We want your engagement. If you're an artist, you know, we have people who joined the Kickstarter giving out postcards in cities. So through Tug, and also through YECRA, this other platform.
How do you spell that?
YECRA is spelled Y-E-K-R-A, and it's a way to take the movie and embed it on your Facebook page or on your blog or in email and actually make the movie viral through streaming or downloads. And you get to participate in some of the revenues. So if you have nothing better to do than to get the gospel of Philip K. Dick out to the world.
Crowdfunding. It's something going, it's funding the crowd.
Yeah, the crowd gets to fund the movie and fund themselves. Same thing with Tug. The promoters on Tug get 5% of the house
for the work
of helping to aggregate people to go see the movie. And I can always be reached through the Facebook page and through our website. And all of the fun of it for me has been engaging with Philip K. Dick fans. One last thing. You know, we were invited to screen at Lincoln Center Film Society as part of their kind of prestigious Indie Night series curated by Christine Vachon and Ted Hope, two amazing indie producers. And Philip K. Dick's friend and publisher, David Hartwell, showed up for the screening and afterwards came to me with tears in his eyes and thanked me and told me how much he loved the movie and said that he knew Philip K. Dick would have loved the spirit of this movie, too, that the love in it was so apparent. And, you know, the New York Times may or may not give us a good review. You never know. You never know who's going to like the movie or not. But, you know, the satisfaction of hearing that is something that, you know, makes this long journey really worthwhile to me. And I hope people listening to this will check it out and get the word out. Because if you want to see these kinds of more intellectual science fiction movies that aren't just Sturm und Drang on screen, then, you know, you got to support them. We get the kind of movies we want to see in the final analysis.
They are few and far between. Last one I can think of offhand was Cold Souls, which starred Paul Giamatti.
Paul Giamatti, and it also starred Catherine Winnick, who's in our movie, and who's also the star of Vikings. So if for no other reason than she is so incredibly beautiful.
And it was rumored that Paul Giamatti was going to play Dick and the Owl in the Mirror, wasn't it?
Paul Giamatti was at one time attached to play Philip K. Dick in Owl and Daylight, which was a biopicture HBO was going to do that just hasn't happened and probably won't happen at HBO. But, you know, could be interesting.
But Giamatti would be good casting also.
Yeah, you know, I'm very happy. At one time I thought about Paul Giamatti for this. But, you know, it was funny. So many of Dick's friends who knew him when he was sort of the age in Radio Free Albemuth came up to me and said, Paul Giamatti would it be terrible casting for this movie. And I always thought he would be good, too.
I agree, because, as you said, it's the Romero Brightley. You're not portraying Philip K. Dick as he existed. You're portraying a character from a novel called Radio Free Albemuth, who's named Philip K. Dick, who's a science fiction writer.
Which is all true, but I think they were implying that he wasn't a nebbishy kind of guy, that he was a little more dashing than that. You met him, I didn't, so I will defer not only to your greater knowledge, but also to your enormous generosity.
I do know a woman who found him very dashing. So
it may be the same woman who came up to me.
I don't think so. But I dare not speak her name.
Science fiction writer?
No.
Oh, this one was a science fiction writer.
This one is not.
Ursula Guin went to high school with Philip K. Dick, but they never met each other in high school.
They never met, but they corresponded a great deal in the back pages of fanzines.
Yes.
In the letters pages, as did Joanna Russ.
Yes.
So, two final question, two words. What's next?
Well, what's next is three things. One is I'm finishing a script of an adaptation of a great Lucius Shepard novel called Handbook of American Prayer. Secondarily, I am hoping to get Flow My Tears, the Policeman Said, going.
For all of you on the radio, that's Handbook of American Prayer.
And will you agree with me that it's one of the most...
I got that copy at Lucius's memorial, like, the day before.
I am only just starting on it. It was handed out at Lucius's memorial, which was last Sunday, which I recorded and filmed by Gulliver, his son.
Who I met on Friday for the first time.
Yeah.
Well, it's an amazing novel. He was an amazing writer, so that's one thing that's next.
Another guy who sat in this room recording.
Ah, he wasn't on your list.
He must be. I have to append that list all the time.
The other thing that's next is trying to get a A-list director, an A-list star back involved with Flow My Tears, the policeman said. I really want to see that made as a producer and as a screenwriter. And then the third thing for me as a director, working on these small budgets that I like to work on, is an adaptation I did of Jim Thompson's Nothing More Than Murder, which is a terrific novel. He wrote The Grifters and The Getaway, which I produced as a studio-level movie. And I want to do something very, like I did with Radio Free Album, that tried to really channel Philip K. Dick's spirit. That's what I have tried to do with Jim Thompson's spirit in Nothing More Than Murder. So that's what's next.
Very good. Well, again, John Allen Simon, thank you so much.
June 27th, Radio Free Album with 10 cities, theaters, but available everywhere digitally also. And Tug and Yakra, and keep in touch.
Tug and Yakra are platforms I haven't heard of. I found that very fascinating. And I have to say that if you are, like me, a Philip K. Dick fan / fanatic, yeah, you definitely owe it to yourself to see that movie. It is extremely faithful to the spirit, novel, concept, and ideas of Phil Dick, and all that. Some of the reviews have been dismissive, which I think is unfair. It's nothing to dismiss. I thought the review in The Hollywood Reporter was very good, which basically said what John said. Look for it online. Now, okay, I'm not going to say you shouldn't go to the Quad Cinema. It's my stupid phone. I say okay, and it does stuff. You should go to the Quad Cinema and check it out. Go with a group of PKD fans. Read the novel. Personally, I recommend the novel, Radio Free Album, with over the so-called Vallis Trilogy, because they're all about Vallis. Vallis, I mean, it's fascinating stuff, and if you want to get into the cult of it, by all means do so. And we should point out that Weirdo Number 7, that's a comic put out by the great R. Crumb, written by his wife, Linda Crumb, and illustrated by R. Crumb, tells that whole story. And while I have only a minute left, nevertheless, I am going to tell you all a quick story that I have not told on the air before, and that's rare. There was a woman that I admired and was doing some computer work for, and partly to impress her, I was telling her all about the writings of Philip K. Dick. She was quite open to hearing about this, and she was also very interested in certain religious themes and concepts that Dick deals with in his own bizarre view of the exegesis and all that. The Judaism of Jesus is what it comes down to. We're not talking about the Jews of Jesus. We're talking about, you know, a real vision, and the word vision is what's involved here. And as it is seen, it is depicted in the movie. It is shown in that comic book, which I mentioned. And as we are talking, as I'm talking to this woman, I notice that she is wearing a necklace. And I ask her, what is that you're wearing, knowing full well that it comes right out of this story of Phil Dick? And she said, oh, this is a particular kind of a fish. It's a symbol that was worn by the early Christians, which are exactly the words that in Dick's vision, her third eye opens up immense a pink light and went into Phil Dick's brain, giving him that, I've forgotten the word, it's the opposite of amnesia. It's the understanding that we all today live in the time of Jesus, that our leaders are Pontius Pilate, and that everything else has melted away. And as she said these words, nothing happened. Oh, well. It was weird enough that that much of it had happened, that I was living a legend that Phil Dick had lived, and I don't think that she was having me on. Speaking of having me on, I'm glad that you had your radio on to listen to us. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will not be back next week exactly. I'll be back for half an hour from 1:30 to 2 with a review by Dan Persons, and I haven't figured out what the rest of the half hour will be. I will be at ReaderCon having a marvy time, I promise you, and recording a lot of interviews there. Lister will be here as of 2 o'clock with a special edition of Burn Baby Burn Clappers, and I gotta tell you now, because I booked it September 9th, you know my New York Review of Science Fiction readings? We will start the next season, the 24th season, with nothing less than Walter Mosley. Whoa. Okay. So, watch Devil with a Blue Dress before you come. Don't forget that Mosley now writes science fiction. You see, that's part of the point. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with, well, all kinds of stuff. Thank you for listening. Visit me primarily at this point on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group, or in the WBAI radio group, or at Jim Freund. And if you like the web, there's always OurWolf.com. Again, have a wonderful morning. Take care. Be good to each other. And yeah, check out Radio Free Albemuth while you're at it. Book and movie.
But how can I do that when I wander in my home. I've watched her change from toys to boys, and now she is my size. So how could I forget her now, when she can share my life? Mommy, I love your daughter. No gesturing, no one can make me leave her. No gesturing, so you can tell her anything you want, but I'll never let her out of my sight. Tell her how much I'm not her type, but one day she's gonna be my wife. Mommy, I love your daughter. No gesturing, no one can make me leave her. It's no she told me I should wait until you're 21. But she just don't understand that I'm a very impatient man. I won't let the horse run away before I go to close the gate. I don't believe in promises, cause promises can fool my belief. Mommy, I love your daughter.